Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the Rancho Tehama Convocation on this Sunday morning. If we could bow our heads for a word of prayer. Dear Father in heaven, we thank you for being with us throughout this weekend, throughout these studies. We also thank you for being with us as we prepared these studies. We pray for each one that is listening to the broadcast. We pray for each one that has been here this weekend, that your Holy Spirit will work on the minds to be open, to understand the truth you have for us at this time. We pray for your presence now as we go through the last two presentations, that you will continue to open minds to this truth. We thank you for hearing and answering our prayers. In Jesus' name, amen. I would like to, before we begin here, state that if you have seen these last two presentations before, you definitely want to see them again because we have some new material and we have added to part 10, some stuff that none of you have seen before, and it just makes this stronger. So with that said, let's begin on part 9, the time of trouble. Again, this is a picture of the Wailing Wall, where the Jews mourn the loss of their nation and the loss of their nationhood. Had they interpreted prophecy correctly, they would not be mourning at the Wailing Wall. The trials of the children of Israel and their attitude just before the first coming of Christ have been presented before me again and again to illustrate the position of the people of God in their experience before the second coming of Christ. How the enemy sought every occasion to take control of the minds of the Jews, and today he is seeking to blind the minds of God's servants that they may not be able to discern the precious truth. Satan is working that the history of the Jewish nation may be repeated in the experience of those who claim to believe present truth. I've read this statement many times, but it wasn't until I read Raymond Cottrell's exposition of Daniel and the 2300 days that I understood what it meant. The Jews applied the 2300-day prophecy and the other prophecies of Daniel to Antiochus Epiphanes. And Raymond Cottrell did exactly the same thing. And many Adventists today and evangelicals are also doing exactly the same thing. I never realized that the history of the Jews being repeated would be so exact that they would even repeat the false interpretation of the prophecy, the exact false interpretation of the prophecy. I guess if it worked the first time, it'll work the second time. There was a present truth, a truth at that time of special importance. In the days of Christ, of Paul, of Luther, there is a present truth for the church today. But truth is no more desired by the men of today than it was by the Jews in the time of Christ, or by papists in the days of Luther. Therefore, Satan, working now with tenfold greater power, tenfold, succeeds as of old in blinding the eyes of men and darkening their understanding. Let us read and study the 12th chapter of Daniel. It is a warning that we shall all need to understand before the time of the end. And what is that warning? Where is it in chapter 12? It is in verse 1. In our previous studies, we showed how the Adventist pioneers did not teach that the King of the North was the papacy. We have also shown that the presentation of Daniel 11 and the King of the North as the Ottoman Empire was the keynote of all Adventist prophecy seminars. Ellen White never made an objection to this mode of preaching, but said it aroused much interest. We have also proved that the Ottoman Empire has fulfilled every single word regarding the King of the North in Daniel 11:40-45. In our last study, we showed how the time of trouble is to start before the close of probation, and how Ellen White even claims it was starting in her day. We also showed how the Sunday law does not come until just before the close of probation, right before the plagues, and that there will be no time then to get ready. Today we are going to look more closely at the time of trouble itself, along with the history of the 20th century, to see if there is enough evidence to support the idea that we have been living in the time of trouble since sometime around 1922. And we know Ellen White said we were already entering it in 1904, so it was sometime before 1922. There are three distinct periods within the time of trouble of Daniel 12:1. It is true that when Sister White quotes Daniel 12:1, she is often talking about Jacob's trouble. She defines the time of national trouble, Jacob's trouble, and the seven last plagues, all of which are covered very briefly by the angel with the words, "A time of trouble such as never was since there was a nation." We also saw in our last study that the Sunday law comes not at the beginning of the time of trouble, but almost simultaneously with the close of probation. The Lord has shown me repeatedly that it is contrary to the Bible to make any provision for our temporal wants in the time of trouble. I saw that if the saints had food laid up by them or in the field in the time of trouble, when sword, famine, and pestilence are in the land, it would be taken from them by violent hands, and strangers would reap their fields. And we saw this in the history of the Armenians. Those who had farms, the farms were harvested or destroyed by the Turks. Those who had food, it was taken from them violently. We also saw this happen in the Bolshevik Revolution in Russia. If anybody had food stores, it was either destroyed or stolen. It has been fulfilled, it is being fulfilled, and it will be fulfilled again. It will happen here. The judgments of God are in the land, the wars and rumors of wars, the destruction by fire and flood say clearly that the time of trouble, which is to increase until the end, is already in the world. We are standing on the threshold of the crisis of the ages. On the threshold. Notice this was published in 1914. World War I began in August of 1914. In quick succession, the judgments of God will follow one another. Fire and flood and earthquake with war and bloodshed. And just to put this into perspective, the Armenian genocide is commemorated on April 24. April 24 is a date when all the Armenian intellectuals were rounded up by the Turks in Constantinople and imprisoned. Most of them were later killed. This happened on April 24 of 1915. And just a few weeks later, the order went out for the deportation of all Armenians, and they really started rounding them up and sending them on the death march. This was May and June and July of 1915. Ellen White died in July of 1915. So she was writing just prior to the events, and they actually started happening right when she died. These were the events she was talking about. The time of trouble has already begun. This is 1907. We hear continually of riots and accidents, of murders and robberies. Boy, if it was true then, what is it today? Human life is no longer safe unless under the protection of God. God's servants must not be surprised that they meet with great difficulties and persecution at this time. The work in Russia opened up somewhere in the 90s, 1890s. And remember the quotes where she said, if we don't do our work now, we will have to do it under great difficulty and persecution? Do you realize that the work in Russia closed up in 1917? How many years did they have? 27? That was it. And the work in Russia has been so terribly difficult since. And China. The first Adventist missionaries went to China somewhere around 1905. And all Adventist missionaries left China in 1949. We look to the future for these things to be fulfilled, when all we need to do is look around us and see them being fulfilled. Persecution at this time. There's another interesting thing about the Armenian genocide. The Adventist message in Turkey received great reception among the Armenians. Lots of them accepted it compared to other ethnic groups in Turkey. And while the Adventist membership in Turkey was not very large at the outbreak of World War I, at the end of World War I, it had been cut in half. Half of the Seventh-day Adventists in Turkey died in that genocide. Three-quarters of the Adventist ministers also died in that genocide. The man who was the most influential, the most successful in bringing the Adventist doctrine, the Adventist message to Turkey, was an Armenian by the name of Baharian. And he also died in the genocide. And it took me a long time to find out how he died. Before 1915, you had a lot of reports about Baharian in the Review and other Adventist publications, and glowing reports of his success and the people he was bringing into the church. And then he disappears after the war. There's nothing about him. I had to search and search and search before I finally found the reference. I believe it was in the Gleaner, but I'm not sure. Anyway, it was in 1940, and I have it in my files. I have to look it up, but in the 1940s, there was an obituary notice for his wife that she had died in Colorado. And there it told the story of how her husband had been killed by a Turkish taxi driver in Armenia. Actually, he was on his way to, in Turkey, he was on his way to Constantinople, and he'd been killed by his taxi driver in 1915. The thing that I find interesting with this is the fact that these people are not remembered by the Adventist Church as martyrs. They are simply buried and forgotten. I wonder why that is. Well, I guess, you know what? If we remembered them as martyrs, we would have a little bit of trouble with our concept that the 20th century was a time of peace, wouldn't we? In his day, the world's Redeemer, the Son of God, was shamefully treated by the people he came to bless. He had to go from city to city to ensure his safety, and this persecution followed him until his work on earth was accomplished. What does the time of trouble consist of? Not just the enforcement of Sunday sacredness, the mark of the beast. It consists of nations getting angry, lawlessness, wars and rumors of wars, destruction by fire and flood, everything in the world being in a state of agitation, the Spirit of God withdrawing from the earth, calamity following calamity by sea and by land, tempests, hurricanes, tornadoes, cloudbursts, earthquakes, fires, floods, murders of every grade, insecurity and lack of assurance in anything human or earthly, the world being stirred with the spirit of war stirring the nations from one end of earth to the other, A period of stormy times for God's people. A time of trial, riots, accidents, murders, robberies, where human life is no longer safe unless under the protection of God. And by the way, all these phrases up here were taken from various quotes in the Spirit of Prophecy. And you see some of them are repeated, but they're all from the Spirit of Prophecy. It is a time of great difficulties, persecution, suffering, calamities, and casualties by land and sea, with the state of society being in an unsettled condition, a period with alarms of war, with agencies of evil combining their forces and consolidating and strengthening for the last great crisis, with great changes taking place, the final movements being rapid ones, having perplexities that were scarcely dreamed of, with all these things forecasting events of the greatest magnitude. I had a book that was a collection of various essays written in the 20th century, and I wasn't too thrilled with the contents of the book, but the foreword to the book was very interesting. The editor who put it together made some comments in the book, and she said, you know, in the last century, in the 1800s, they spent the whole century dealing with the aftermath of the French Revolution and the Napoleonic Wars. They digested it, trying to understand what it was. It was the big thing throughout the 1800s. Everybody discussed it, talked about it, and all of this. They had all this time to process it. She says, the 20th century has been altogether different in that we had the worst war in history in 1915, and then the World War II came on the heels of it so fast we had no time to process the first one. And then the Cold War followed the World War II so quickly that we couldn't even process World War II before we were in Vietnam. And then we were in the Middle East. And she says the events of the 20th century have been so much more rapid than any previous century that we can't even process the first one before the next one starts. And it is getting worse. And she said this. She isn't a Christian. She's a totally secular person. And this is what she is saying about the 20th century and what has happened. The final movements will be rapid ones. Even the world is commenting on how rapid things have been in the last 100 years. When we consider warfare in history, we immediately find that the most destructive wars in history have occurred in the last 100 years. World War I was the most destructive war and caused more casualties than any previous war in history. There were more than 35 million casualties in this war. Compare this with the Napoleonic Wars, which killed, at most, about 6.5 million. That's all Napoleon managed to kill. Hitler all by himself did better than that, or worse than that, you want to put it the proper way. And what about Stalin with the 30 million people he killed? And that wasn't in war. But within 20 years, World War II started, which killed more than 70 million people. Double! This war was so bad, it makes World War I, the worst war in history, look like a mild conflict. I have read that World War II killed more people than all previous wars combined, including World War I. Never before in history have we had two such destructive wars within 100 years. Yet these two wars occurred within 30 years of each other. Besides the world wars, there have been one war after another during the last century. We had the Russian Civil War in 1917, taking 9 million lives. The Mexican Revolution in 1911, with 2 million killed. In 1950, the Korean War killed 3.5 million. Then we had Vietnam with over 6 million. The War on Terror itself has claimed more than 4 million lives, and I think I can raise that number now. In addition to this, there are all the genocides that have happened. The last 100 years has been the deadliest century in history, and there were many more conflicts during this time that we didn't even mention. In all, there have probably been more than 200 million deaths from the sword or military operations in just the last 100 years. Look at this chart here. You have the blue representing the 1700s. Then you have the yellow, the 1800s. Yeah, it's quite a bit more than the blue. Actually, the numbers from the 1700s are kind of hard to add up, but it's not very much. And in the 1800s, again, it's not easy to add it up, and it is quite a bit more. But look at the 20th century. Look at the 1900s. It more than doubled what happened in the 1800s. Something is going on. I was shown the inhabitants of the earth in the utmost confusion. This vision, by the way, was given to Sister White during the Civil War. War, bloodshed, privation, want, famine, and pestilence were abroad in the land. As these things surrounded God's people, they began to press together and to cast aside their little difficulties. My attention was then called from the scene. There seemed to be a little time of peace. Once more, the inhabitants of the earth were presented before me, and again, everything was in the utmost confusion. Strife, war, and bloodshed with famine and pestilence raged everywhere. Other nations were engaged in this war and confusion. War caused famine. Want and bloodshed caused pestilence. And then men's hearts failed them for fear and for looking after those things which are coming on the earth. Isn't that what we just talked about? We had a war. A bad war. And people described going through Turkey after World War I and how the people were starving because all the fruit trees had been cut down to provide for fuel during the war. The men had been killed in the conflict. There was nobody harvesting the fields or even planting the fields. In some areas of Turkey, 30% of the women were widows. Because their men had been killed in the conflict. And they starved. And in the aftermath of starvation came disease. Remember the Spanish flu? 1918 to 19? That was in the aftermath of this war. People wouldn't have succumbed to that flu the way they did had they not been starving because their food supplies had been destroyed in this massive conflict. And then we have a time of peace. And then we have a bigger conflict, much bigger, with more nations involved. And immediately following this big conflict, we have a time of men's hearts failing them for fear. And if you know anything about the Cold War, and the nuclear holocaust we have been on the verge of since World War II, your heart would fail you for fear too. And the only reason it doesn't is because you're ignorant. We could, with the push of one button, one madman could wipe this earth out. We have enough nuclear power in the U.S. submarines right now to obliterate every continent in the world twice. And it could happen in minutes. The world has never lived with this kind of fear. And the only reason we are still here, the only reason we are still alive is because God is overruling. Do you know how many times we were on the verge of nuclear war, all out nuclear war in the last 60 years? And they keep revealing more times when the president had his finger on the red button and was ready to push it, was within minutes of launching those nuclear warheads and wiping out all of Asia. And it didn't happen. We have God to thank that we're still here. Anybody who knows is scared to death unless they have the Lord with them. Most Adventists believe that this is predicting wars that are still future. But is it not a perfectly accurate description of World Wars I and II? A terrible conflict, then a time of peace, followed by a more terrible conflict with more and different nations involved. Have we not seen men's hearts fail them for fear of a nuclear holocaust ever since World War II? Surely the Lord God will do nothing, but he revealeth his secrets unto his servants, the prophets. And I keep saying this as I read the history of the 20th century over and over and over again. I say, if God didn't warn us about this, he made a big mistake. And my God doesn't make mistakes. He knew it was coming, and he told us it was coming, but we have ignored it. What is interesting is that Sister White wrote those words during the Civil War, in the middle of an article about that conflict. And modern historians consider the American Civil War to be the first modern war, a foretaste of what would happen in World Wars I and II. And here's another one. John writes, I beheld and I heard the voice of many angels round about the throne. Angels were united in the work of him who had broken the seals and taken the book. Four mighty angels hold back the powers of this earth till the servants of God are sealed in their foreheads. That's the only reason this world hasn't been wiped out. If those angels weren't holding back those four winds, this world wouldn't even be here today. Man has the power to completely wipe this world out of existence. And the only reason he hasn't done it is because these angels are holding back these winds of strife. And woe be to this earth when they let them go. And they have let them go a little at a time, but they're still holding because there's still a little bit of time to be sealed. The nations of the world are eager for conflict, but they are held in check by the angels. When this restraining power is removed, there will come a time of trouble and anguish. Deadly instruments of warfare will be invented. This was written in 1900. Can you think of what's been invented since 1900 that's deadly? I can think of a lot of things. Vessels with their living cargo will be entombed in the great deep. All who have not the spirit of truth will unite under the leadership of satanic agencies. But they are to be kept under control till the time shall come for the great battle of Armageddon. This was written in 1900. Think about it. The airplane had not yet been invented. The airplane was invented 3 years later. Today, we not only have warplanes, but incendiary bombs, nuclear bombs, napalm bombs that burn with white hot heat, laser weapons that reduce their targets to the molecular level, and a host of other instruments of warfare that could not even have been conceived of in her day. Who would have dreamed of the nuclear bomb in 1900? It didn't exist. They are the most sinister and deadly weapons ever known. Man's power for weapons of mass destruction have increased incredibly. And here's an interesting one. In India, China, Russia, and the cities of America, thousands of men and women are dying of starvation. The moneyed men, because they have the power, control the market. They purchase at low rates all they can obtain and then sell at greatly increased prices. This means starvation to the poorer classes and will result in a civil war. There will be a time of trouble such as never was since there was a nation. This was written in 1899. In 1917, the Bolshevik Revolution occurred and the Russian Civil War began with food riots in the Russian capital of St. Petersburg. Food riots! She said the civil wars in Russia, China, India, and the cities of America would be a result of starvation and high food prices. Russia was the first of the nations mentioned to see civil war in 1917. It is interesting that the Bolshevik Revolution began with food riots in the Russian capital. This was followed by the division of India and Pakistan in 1947, which was another bloody civil war. Then we had China in 1949 with Mao Zedong. We have not yet seen civil war in the cities of America. At least I don't think we have. We've got riots. I suppose you could call the conflicts of the civil rights movement a type of civil war in the cities of America. But that doesn't preclude the possibility that it is coming. We may yet be seeing in the near future civil war in the streets of American cities. And there are people who are expecting this to happen. They're predicting this is going to happen. And these are non-Christians that are predicting this. But that time could certainly be coming. And we have certainly seen plenty of rioting and violence in American cities in the last 100 years. Lots of it. Can we brush this fulfillment of prophecy aside as insignificant? Are we not nearing the great climax of the time of trouble? Now, here's a really interesting one. In the visions of the night, a very impressive scene passed before me. I saw an immense ball of fire fall among some beautiful mansions, causing their instant destruction. And here we have a picture of a mansion in Hiroshima. And then we have another picture of the exact same mansion in Hiroshima. An immense ball of fire, instant destruction. Did she see the atomic bomb? On August 6, 1945, the first choice target, Hiroshima, was having clear weather. At 8:15 a.m. local time, the Enola Gay's door sprang open and dropped little boy. The bomb exploded, ball of fire, 1,900 feet above the city and only missed the target, the Aoi Bridge, by approximately 800 feet. Two-thirds of Hiroshima was destroyed. Within 3 miles of the explosion, 60,000 of the 90,000 buildings were demolished. Clay roof tiles had melted together. Shadows had imprinted on buildings and other hard surfaces. Metal and stone had melted. And if you do a little bit of research on the internet, there are actual color photographs of the aftermath of that bomb. There are color video footage that has recently been released of the aftermath of this bomb. An immense ball of fire causing instant destruction. And here's another one. In the night, I thought, in a room, but not in my own house. I was in a city. Where? I knew not. And I heard expression after expression. Today we would say explosion after explosion. I rose up quickly in bed and saw from my window large balls of fire. Jetting out were sparks in the form of arrows, and buildings were being consumed. And in a very few minutes, the entire block of buildings was falling, and the screeching and mourning groans came distinctly to my ears. I cried out in my raised position to learn what was happening. Where am I, and where are our family circle? Then I awoke, but I could not tell where I was, for I was in another place than home. I said, "Oh, Lord, where am I, and what shall I do?" It was a voice that spoke, "Be not afraid. Nothing shall harm you." I was instructed that destruction hath gone forth upon cities. The word of the Lord will be fulfilled. Isaiah 29:19-24 was repeated. I dared not move, not knowing where I was. I cried unto the Lord, "What does it mean?" These representations of destruction were repeated. So she saw it all again. Where am I? In scenes I have presented, and again, this is a quote from the angel or the words that were spoken to her. In scenes I have presented that which will be, but warn my people to cease from putting their trust in men who are not obedient to my warnings and who despise my reproofs. For the day of the Lord is right upon the world when evidence shall be made sure. Those who have followed the voices that would turn things upside down will themselves be turned where they cannot see, but will be as blind men. Manuscript Releases, Volume 2, page 361. This occurred in 1906. Or this vision occurred in 1906. Here is a picture of Dresden, Germany in the 1890s. And at the bottom is a picture of Dresden, Germany after the firestorm of 1945. And the people who lived through this said they thought the end of the world had come. Fireballs falling from airplanes. Buildings turning into this huge conflagration. The asphalt melting. People getting caught in it and going up like torches. People stuck in hot asphalt screaming for help and no one able to help them. People down in the bomb shelters getting so hot that their bodies actually melted until the liquid was 4 or 5 feet deep. This is what happened in Dresden in 1945. Near the end of World War II, millions of refugees from the Eastern Front flooded into Germany. Trying desperately to escape the Russians and assured by the Allies that Dresden, the capital city of Saxony, would not be bombed, more than a million sought refuge in the city. But after luring the people there, the Allies double-crossed these people and firebombed the city on February 13. There were no military targets there. This was done purposely to get rid of the people. Turning the city into a hurricane of flames, creating winds that sucked people and animals into the inferno. More people died in this disaster than were killed in Hiroshima and Nagasaki combined. They also did it to Hamburg. And the people who went through this, who survived, said it was hell. They thought the end of the world had come. This is what she saw in vision. No wonder she was scared. I would be too. And here's another one. Last Friday morning, just before I awoke, a very impressive scene was presented before me. I seemed to awake from sleep, but was not in my home. From the windows, I could behold a terrible conflagration. Great balls of fire were falling upon houses, and from these balls, fiery arrows were flying in every direction. It was impossible to check the flames that were kindled, and many places were being destroyed. The terror of the people was indescribable. After a time, I awoke and found myself at home. So this was repeated to her more than once, and she didn't understand what it meant. An incendiary bomb, and here's a picture of one. Isn't that a ball of fire with fiery arrows extending out from it? She was describing this, and the one over on the right is a white phosphorus. An incendiary bomb dropped from an airplane appears like a ball of fire dropped from the sky with fiery arrows flying out in all directions, causing fires that are unquenchable. Remember, incendiary bombs were not dropped from airplanes until after World War I, more than 10 years after Ellen White received this vision. She saw it, and she wrote it. And another one, there will be crimes greater than any now on record. Before the word genocide was invented, it was actually invented in the 1930s, the Armenians called what had happened to them in 1915 the Great Crime. Crimes greater than any now on record? There will be weeping and lamentation and woe. Already the sprinklings from the vial of God's wrath have been let fall upon land and sea. This was 1890, she was writing this. Affecting the elements of the air. The causes of these unusual conditions are being searched for, but in vain. These things are the result of drops from the vials of God's wrath being sprinkled on the earth and are but faint representations of what will be in the near future. Earthquakes in various places have been felt, But these disturbances have been very limited, and the religious world too is to be terribly shaken, for the end of all things is at hand. You know, going through the history, reading through the reviews on the King of the North kind of had a side effect. Because you get the PDF of the whole review. So you have the article that you're interested in, but you have all the other articles from everybody else. And it's really easy to start flipping through and seeing other things that were being said. And what I find fascinating is in the 1800s, they were quoting things from the current newspapers. Oh, this shipwreck, 3,000 people were killed. This is evidence of how near we are to the end. Or we have this flood and 2,000 people die. This is evidence. Things are really getting bad. And I'm sitting here and I'm reading this and I'm going, but 1,000 people, 2,000 people? That's not very bad. I mean, today we regularly have disasters that kill 2 and 300,000 people. That tells you how bad it has gotten today from what it was when they thought it was bad. But because we live with it, we don't think about it. The Holocaust is certainly a crime greater than any on record when Sister White wrote that. And today, natural disasters are increasing at an astounding rate. In comparison to previous years, the number of casualties from natural disasters in 2010, this was 5 years ago, which is already well above 200,000, is outside the norm. Over the decade from 2000 to the end of 2009, the yearly average was 78,000, according to the United States Nation's International Strategy for Disaster Reduction. I don't think they're going to succeed in reducing it. For the 1990s, the average was 43,000. So from 2000 to 2009, the yearly average of people dying in natural disasters almost doubled. And we've all been alive during that period of time. And here's another quote from the internet. The total natural disasters. The last one was dealing with total numbers of people killed. This is dealing with the number of disasters. The total number of natural disasters reported each year has been steadily increasing in recent decades, from 78 in 1970 to 348 in 2004. A portion of that increase is artificial, due in part to better media reports and advances in communications. However, about two-thirds of the increase is real and the result of rises in so-called hydrometeorological disasters. These disasters include droughts, tsunamis, hurricanes, typhoons, and floods, and have been increasing over the past 25 years. In 1980, there were only about 100 such disasters reported per year, but that number has risen to over 300 a year since 2000. And right now, California is in the worst drought it has ever seen since it's been recording the weather. In our town of Willits, last year, there was less rainfall recorded than has ever been recorded since they started keeping records over 100 years ago. We have never had a drought this bad in California. Is it getting worse? And who knows how long this drought is going to last? Some people are predicting that California is going to become a ghost state because there's going to be no water. They're already preventing the farmers from planting crops because they have no water to water the crops. Farmers are already leaving because they can't make a livelihood because they can't water their crops. Wars, fires, and natural disasters have increased dramatically in the 20th century, but so have the famines and pestilence. Were you aware that the worst famine on record occurred in China? From 1958 to 61, The government has ruthlessly suppressed the figures, but the estimate is that 43 million people perished in just 3 years. 43 million. My mind doesn't even fathom the size of these numbers that we're dealing with. This is almost too big to comprehend. But this has not been the only famine. When you add together just the major famines, not the minor ones, the major ones of the last 100 years, the total is around 75 million dead just from famine. But millions have also died of the pestilence in the 20th century. In 1918 to 19 alone, nearly 100 million people died of the Spanish flu. We may think that we are conquering disease, but when you consider cancer and all the other diseases we suffer from today, it is obvious that pestilence rages in the world. In the United States alone, out of a population of about 300 million, at least 100 million are chronically ill. It is difficult to find the numbers of deaths from pestilence in previous centuries to compare these numbers to, but we do know that the Black Death killed 75 million people over a span of 500 years. And here we had 100 million die in 1 year, just of the flu. Is it getting worse? God has not restrained the powers of darkness from carrying forward their deadly work of vitiating the air, polluting it. One of the sources of life and nutrition with a deadly miasma. Not only is vegetable life affected, but man suffers from pestilences. Cholera and unexplained diseases have broken out. Vitiating the air. Here we have Chernobyl and Fukushima. It's very hard to tell, but hundreds of thousands of people have died as a result of both of these disasters. A nuclear disaster at a power plant is way worse than an atomic bomb. Because when you drop a bomb, it explodes, and you get all the fallout from that, and then it's done. With these plants, they are still there, and they're continuing to emit radiation constantly, constantly, constantly. They have encapsulated Chernobyl, but you know what? The dome that they put over it to contain the radiation is deteriorating, and it is going to fall apart soon, and Russia doesn't have the funds to repair it. Whoever came up with nuclear power energy was crazy. This stuff is deadly. This is certainly true today, vitiating the air. And Satan uses men as his helpers in this. Consider the massive aerosol campaigns that are going on and the major nuclear disasters of the last century that have certainly given the air a deadly taint of radiation. And we have it here on the west coast of the United States, Fukushima. You can see the cloud where it went. It came right over here. I was reading some of the statistics, and I can't remember how many there were, but they saw a major increase in the hospitals in Sacramento, Portland, and Seattle of stillbirths within 3 months of this disaster. And you know what the United States told its people? A little radiation is good for you. And you know, they immediately raised the levels of radiation that they said were safe. And the next thing they did was they pulled all radiation meters off the West Coast right after this happened so that people wouldn't know because they didn't want people to panic. But what about persecution and the Sunday law? We always hear that persecution and martyrdom are coming soon. But let's consider the history of persecution in the last 100 years. We talked about the Armenian Genocide in a previous study. When the genocide was over, only 2 Adventist call porters were left alive in Turkey. And as I was saying earlier, some people have come in since I said this. The Armenians were very receptive to the Adventist message in Turkey. When World War I started, there were quite a few Armenians in the SDA church in Turkey. When World War II ended, one half of the SDA church members in Turkey were dead. Three quarters of the SDA ministers were dead. The work had to start over almost from scratch. And I keep wondering why the Adventist church doesn't remember these as martyrs. But if they did, they would have to admit that something major has happened in the 20th century. And this is something they do not want to admit. The Jews claim 6 million deaths in the Nazi camps in World War II. But since the Nazi files have been unsealed, the numbers have risen to more than 10 million. And actually, I have read that according to the Nazi files, it's 14 million that the Nazis claim were Jews. Now, there's a huge discrepancy between those two numbers. The Jews say 6 million, and they're sticking to that number. They claim that 6 million of their people died, and the Nazis claim they killed 14 million of them. That's an 8 million difference. Who are the other people that the Nazis consider Jews, but the Jews don't claim as their own? This is interesting. Before we did this study, I had no idea of the history of Eastern Europe. While it is impossible to know for sure who all these people were, we do know who some of them were. During the Reformation, there were some reformers who were known as Anabaptists because they did not believe in infant baptism. Of these, there was a small group who adopted the Seventh-day Sabbath. Not accepted and persecuted by the Protestants, some of these went with Count Zinzendorf to create a Sabbath-keeping colony in Moravia. Moravia is part of what today is Czechoslovakia, that is Eastern Europe. Some of these Sabbath-keepers also moved to America, where Count Zinzendorf visited them in the 1700s. This American group later organized themselves into the Seventh-day Baptist denomination. And if you remember your Adventist history, it was a Seventh-day Baptist by the name of Rachel Oakes who introduced Joseph Bates to the Sabbath. And Joseph Bates then brought it to what became Seventh-day Adventists. So this is our roots, friends. This is where we're getting this. It's coming from Eastern Europe. Of the group who remained in Europe, some began to adopt the Jewish feast days and learned Hebrew. They eventually gave up the New Testament and belief in Jesus. This was a very small group that did this. There was a much larger group that kept their Christianity and still kept the Sabbath. They adopted Jewish dress, becoming Jews in everything but name and race. Known as Sabbatarians or Judaizers, they were persecuted as Jews by the Christians and rejected as Gentiles by the Jews. They formed their own communities, mostly in Eastern Europe. Today, these communities no longer exist. These people were almost entirely wiped out in the Nazi death camps. There's more to this. In fact, there's a lot more to this. In 1822, the Protestant Russian translation of the New Testament was published. They never completely finished the translation of the Old Testament, but I think they had an older translation of that. But Alexander I, the Emperor of Russia, was a Protestant. And he commissioned the publication of this translation of the scriptures. And it got into the hands of a lot of the common people, particularly in the Ukraine and Western Russia. And a very large number of these people, there's something very interesting about this Bible. Let me add this. The concept for this Bible was different from the way a lot of these Bibles were done. The people who translated this Russian Bible believed that the Bible could speak for itself, and they left all notes out of it. There were no notes in this Bible. There was just a foreword, and the foreword told people to read it for themselves, to explain it for themselves, and to save themselves by so doing. Those were the words in the introduction to this Bible. So this is what the people were reading. And there, by the end of the 1800s, there were literally thousands, and I cannot remember the total number, but there were thousands of Christians in Russia who had voluntarily left the Orthodox Church on the basis of reading this translation and had started keeping the seventh-day Sabbath on their own. There were thousands of them in the Ukraine, in Western Russia. They were called the Sabbatniki. You look up the Sabbatniki, you get some interesting information on this. Some of them actually tried to become Jews and give up Christianity, but that was a small group of them. And another interesting point to this is a number of the leaders of the modern nation of Israel today are descendants of these Sabbatniki Russians. They aren't even of Jewish heritage. Most people don't know this. I was, another side effect of going through these articles in the review, I came across, and I don't have a slide with this on it, I'd like to put one in here. I came across a map that they printed in the review in 1924. And this map was a map of Asia, Europe, it had Turkey on it. And on this map they had dots for every Seventh-day Adventist congregation in Europe and Asia. Do you know where most of them were? Eastern Europe and the Ukraine. I didn't know that. There was a reason. There was a very specific reason why the fronts of World War I and World War II were in this region. There was a very systematic plan of getting rid of these independent people. I have a personal interest in this area because both of my grandmothers came to the United States from that region. They were not Russian. I've heard this story ever since I was a real little girl. Catherine the Great of Russia invited the German Protestants who were being persecuted in Europe, the Mennonites and others, even the Lutherans, to come to Russia and live in the Ukraine and farm it. And they came because they were being persecuted in the West. They came to the East. My dad's mom was from a Mennonite group, and they actually originated in Holland. And they came down and they moved to a town that was just north of the Crimean Peninsula in the Ukraine. And they kept their faith, and they formed their own communities, and they spoke German in their own communities. They didn't become part of the Russian peasantry. They had their own communities. They spoke their own language, and they kept their own religion. And they lived there for 100 years. And my grandmother, my grandma Craig, actually showed me a picture of her dad, who was born in Russia. Her family was Lutheran, and they were German. And they were a little further north from where my dad's family was. And I can't remember the exact name of the town, but the English translation was Strawberry Fields. Anyway, they were Lutheran, and her dad was born there. And she showed me a picture of him when he was 3 or 5 years old in the 1880s, taken in Russia before he came to the United States. Now, these two families saw in the 1890s that things were changing in Russia. And they said, we're going to leave. My grandma Craig, her family, her father came to Washington State. My dad's family went to Canada. The reason they went to Canada was because the United States wouldn't guarantee them freedom from military service. And this was something they really strongly believed. Each of them left family members there, brothers and sisters. The families that were left in Russia no longer exist. We cannot trace them. We do know that one brother and all his sons owned a mill, and that they were all killed in the Bolshevik Revolution. But the family over there is gone. The houses that they built are still there. Stone houses, hand-carved furniture, they are there. You can go and visit them. But the people who live there have no idea who built them. And they have no idea what happened to the people who lived there. Have you heard it said that communism must end before the Sunday laws can be enacted? It's time to think again. In the 1890s, the United States was considering Sunday legislation. At the same time, Russia was also considering a national Sunday law. But there was a problem. There was a very large minority in Russia who found the Sunday laws a burden to them economically and lobbied hard for a repeal of the laws. They were the Jews and the Muslims, who did not wish to be forced to keep their businesses closed 2 days out of every week. But then came the Bolshevik Revolution, and guess what day Russians have as a rest day today? Sunday. So far from being an enemy of Rome, communism has helped to enforce the very mark of Rome and prepared the way for the world to wonder after the beast. Even Hitler enacted Sunday laws in Germany. Did you know that? In order to cause economic hardship for the Jews and everyone else who kept the seventh-day Sabbath. The heathen of China worked 7 days a week and did not keep any weekly rest day. Today, after 60 years of communism, China does not work on Sundays. If you do not believe that there has been persecution during the 20th century, you should consider a map of Europe before 1915 and today. Take a look at these religious maps. This is very roughly drawn based on information we've been able to find. The blue is Protestant, the purple is Orthodox, the red is Catholic. This is 1914. Now look at it today. Catholic. I did not know before we did this study that Eastern Europe was never Catholic. The Catholic Church never dominated Eastern Europe. They tried. They never could get the Inquisition going in Romania and Bulgaria and Czechoslovakia and these other countries because the people were too independent and they wouldn't accept it. Today, thanks to communism and the world wars, the Pope has power in these lands. But surely the Pope cannot have supported Nazism and communism just to get rid of Protestants and Jews. Thousands of Catholics were killed as well. Well, let's consider history. Back in the days of the Inquisition, in the 10th through 12th centuries, when the Church was uprooting the Albigensian and Waldensian heresies in southwestern Europe, they came to towns that had mixed Catholic and heretical populations. The troops asked their superiors how they were to tell the Catholics from the heretics. The chilling answer came back, kill them all. God will know his own. The church has not changed. Why did they firebomb Dresden after getting the refugees there? These refugees were from Eastern Europe, Protestant. There was a reason. The time of trouble has already begun. This is 1907. We hear continually of riots and accidents, of murders and robberies. Human life is no longer safe unless under the protection of God. God's servants must not be surprised that they meet with great difficulties and persecution at this time. In his day, the world's Redeemer, the Son of God, was shamefully treated by the people he came to bless. He had to go from city to city to ensure his safety. And this persecution followed him until his work on earth was accomplished. We have no time to lose. Troublous times are before us. The world is stirred with the spirit of war. Soon, the scenes of trouble spoken of in the prophecies will take place. The prophecy in the 11th of Daniel has nearly reached its complete fulfillment. Let all read and understand the prophecies of this book. For we are now entering upon the time of trouble spoken of. Daniel 12:1-4